Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. I got a heart covered in rust, and I want to share. She drank punch, and on her wedding day, we've been on the way to mother. And I want to share. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs have shared the stage with such likes as Junior Brown, Hank Williams Jr., Old Crow Medicine Show, Kinky Friedman, and many more. Their music has been featured on TLC's hit show, Trading Spaces, and on the award-winning Sundance Channel hit show, Rectify. They just released their fourth studio album. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is our old friend V.L. Cox, and the piece that we're featuring is the one back here behind me entitled Backroads from her Images of the American South collection. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and VL at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories revolve around beginnings, endings, or both. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Helga Mullins has to end one way of life to begin another. And we'll end the night with Diana Hampo and her cousins at the beginning of a plot. But let's start the night with Lori Pleggy and an ending she did not see coming in When Tomorrow Starts Without Me.
March 10th, 2007, Eddie, Kevin, Brad, and I drove to Billings, Montana because Eddie had an interview. And on the way, I called my son Anthony because he was in Florida. Guess where we are? Where? We're looking at more rocks and dirt. He started laughing. He said, "Really?" I said, "Yep, we're in the North Dakota Badlands." He said, "Oh, cool." I was really shocked to hear him say that because the last time we went to North Dakota, he said, "More rocks and dirt." He didn't like them at all. And I asked him, I said, "Did I wake you up when I called you?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Good. That makes up for all the times you called me at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke me up." And he started laughing. We had a good conversation. And before we hung up, we said, "I love you." In our household, this was a rule, even if you were mad at each other. Little did I know, that would be the last conversation I would ever have with my son. If I would have known that, I would have kept him on the phone a very long time. I would have told him how proud I was of him for the things he'd done in his life and how far he'd come in life. And I would have told him how much I loved him. And I would have kept him on the phone as long as I could, but I knew he had to go. I got the phone call from Susan around 7 that night, and she was crying. "Lori, this is Susan, Anthony's girlfriend. Something bad has happened to him, and he's in the hospital, and the nurse needs some information from you." I was very calm. I said, "Susan, hand the phone to the nurse, and I will give her the information that she needs." "The nurse needs some information about Anthony," she said again. And again, very calmly, I said, "Susan, hand the phone to the nurse, and I will give her the information that she needs." "The nurse needs some information about Anthony." At this point, I started getting worried, and I said, "Susan, is Anthony dead or alive?" There was a pause, and then, "This phone isn't working. The nurse is going to have to call you back on a landline." And she hung up. A few seconds later, the phone rang again. The nurse started asking me if Anthony had ever been there before, where he lived, what his address was, when he was born, etc. I couldn't answer the part about the address because Anthony was living friend to friend, and I had no idea where he was living at that time. I told her I'd have to call my mother about the insurance because I didn't know if my mother still had him on insurance or not, but I knew at one point in time she did. I asked how he was doing, and she said, "All the doctors and nurses are in the room with your son, and they're doing everything they can to keep him alive." And then I asked her what happened, and she said, "I'll have to have Susan call you back and tell you." Susan called me back, and she said, "Anthony swallowed 3 bait balls of cocaine, and he isn't doing well at all. He was riding in a car with a boy named Rob, who got pulled over, and Anthony had cocaine on him. He freaked out because he didn't want to go back to jail, and he swallowed it. He was taken to Jason's house, where they tried to save him, but they couldn't. They called an ambulance, and the ambulance took him to the hospital. All I could say was, do I need to fly to Florida?" And she said, "I would if I were you." I hung up, took a deep breath, and made the hardest phone call I've ever made in my life. I had to call my mother. When she answered the phone, I explained to her what I knew so far, and she told me that she didn't have insurance on Anthony anymore. She told me that she didn't believe what I was telling her, and I finally made her understand that this was true, that it was really happening. I called the nurse back, and I told her that Anthony had no insurance, and she asked me if they had permission to save my son's life. I told her yes. She said, "Good, because we would have anyway at his age." I called Carrie, Anthony's old girlfriend, and I told her what was going on. Then I asked her to do something I didn't want to know, but I knew I had to in case Anthony didn't make it through this. I asked her where he wanted to be buried. I told her Anthony wouldn't tell me, but that at one point he did tell me Carrie, Jacoby, and Wyatt will know where it is. A few minutes later, Carrie called me back, and she said he wanted to be buried by Chris, a friend of theirs that had died a few years earlier. Not long after that, Aunt Georgie and Jim, who lived in Florida at the time, went to the hospital, and they called me. Aunt Georgie said it didn't look good. She said he was on life support, and that they were doing everything that they could to save him. I felt like I'd been punched in the gut. I felt like this was serious. You know, I didn't really believe it at first, but this was serious. If I would have paid attention to what the nurse told me when I had her on the phone, when she said the doctors and the nurses were in there with Anthony doing everything they could to save his life, I would have realized that he had coded at one point in time. For the first time since the phone rang that night, my legs gave out and I collapsed on the couch. It was going to be a day before I could get to my son, and all I could do was pray that he'd make it. 1 a.m. on March 12, 2007, I walked into the ICU and my son was laying there motionless, hooked up to life support that was breathing for him. "Mama's here, son. Mama's here," is all I could say. I pulled a chair up next to his bed, laid my head on the bed rail, and I just sat there. An hour later, the nurse came in, and she told me I needed to leave so Anthony could rest. Anthony was in the hospital for a week, and he never regained consciousness. In his final moments, I remember looking at his blood pressure, and it was 70 over 40. I placed a pillow on his head to keep it stable. I put my arm across his chest, and I laid my head against his head. At that point, I made my son a promise. I promised him I would buy the plot next to his, and that we'd be buried side by side, the two of us, just like it was when he was young. Mother continued reading off Anthony's vitals to me, and they were still the same. I started talking to Anthony and telling him, "Son, look for Nino." Mother said, "His blood pressure just dropped to 60 over 30. Then I told him, "Look for Chris and JP." Mother then said, "20 over. And I started to panic. "I'm going to freak. I'm going to freak." And the room started to spin, and I felt like I was going to throw up. "No, you are not," Mother said. "You have to stay strong." I said, "You don't understand. I've never in my life touched a dead person, and I'm going to freak." She said, "Lori, this is Anthony, our Anthony, and it'll be okay." I never moved my head from Anthony's. Then she said, "Flatline, flatline, flatline." I felt the air rush out of me. It's over. It's over. Thank God it's over. My baby died in my arms, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Lori Pleggy lives in Little Rock, Arkansas with her husband Cliff and two remaining sons. She wrote, "When tomorrow starts without me, in order to help other parents who have lost a child start healing." Next, Helga Mullins realizes that in order to start, she must first end in the promise.
President Kennedy is coming to Berlin? That's the question I asked an American soldier named Leo in May 1963. Apparently, it was true. The American military had heard about his upcoming visit in advance, and this young man was excited that he would be part of this historic day. I had recently found myself attracted to this soldier, but remembered a promise I had made to my family a few months before, that I would never leave my hometown of Berlin, Germany again. 7 months earlier, after almost 3 years of being far away from home in Australia for a work study program, I came back to a very changed Berlin. While I was away, the Berlin Wall was built essentially overnight, dividing not only our great city's land, but separating loved ones from each other. Luckily, our apartment was on the west side of the wall in the French sector, but the subway stop that I had been walking to for years had a wall just on the other side of it. Upon my return from Australia and not knowing any better, I made the mistake of saying hello to one of the East German soldiers guarding it. His reply was a stone-faced stare. It shocked me that depending on what side of the wall you were on, you were no longer allowed to speak to fellow Berliners. There were barbed wires, watchdogs, mines, and watchtowers. In February 1963, I wanted to use my new English-speaking skills, so I started working for the Americans at McNair Barracks as a night and weekend cashier. Around the end of March of that year, I first met that young soldier named Leo from a place called Little Rock, Arkansas. He was incredibly homesick. I told him the little I had learned about his state in school, that they grew cotton there and had some sort of high school crisis in 1957. About a month or so later, I went into Leo again. This time he had the exciting news that President Kennedy was coming to Berlin. When President Kennedy arrived in Berlin, Leo was at the airport as an honor guard. They presented arms, and then Kennedy shook hands with dignitaries. Then he went back to the barracks to prepare for his visit to Berlin Brigade. Leo was color guard there and was right in front of the review stand. He remembered seeing Kennedy's piercing greenish-gray eyes up close. For me, the day was spent like thousands of other Berliners. I found out his motorcade was passing right down the street from my apartment as it made its way to City Hall. I waited on the curb for 3 hours on that sunny, breezy day. I wondered how Leo's day was going. Had he already seen him? I couldn't wait to share my experience. I was wondering what he thought as an American to be in the presence of his president. We could see the limousine coming and people began chanting in syllables, Kennedy, Kennedy. It was only a split second that I saw him, yet it seemed to happen in slow motion. I remember his beautiful thick hair, his blue suit, his crisp white shirt. After he disappeared from sight, I rushed to work at McNair. I turned on the radio, hoping that I wouldn't have too many customers so I could listen to his speech. I was proud that I could understand the words in English. A few days later, I saw Leo again. He still couldn't believe that this young man from Arkansas was standing only a few feet away from the President of the United States. As a result of Kennedy's visit, Leo and I had a lot more to talk about. I felt a deeper connection to this American soldier. I now felt somewhat of a duty to show him some of the Berlin sights. Over the next few months, we started dating. There was tension with my parents and grandparents. My stepfather and grandfather in particular did not understand the appeal of this young, uncultured man. And they reminded me of my promise to never leave Berlin again. Despite all their warnings, I kept falling deeper and deeper in love. One night, I invited Leo over to dinner at my apartment, and my mother made a very traditional German feast. Wiener Schnitzel, cooked red cabbage, salt potatoes, and cucumber salad. When the dinner was placed on the table, Leo looked at me in disbelief and said, "I'm not eating that." Thank goodness my parents didn't speak English. Leo asked me to make tater tots with pork and beans and weenies cut up in them. My parents sat confused when I started making this southern boy some food he could relate to. Thank God for the PX. In October 1963, the promise was all but broken when Leo and I got engaged. I told my family that American forces would be in Berlin a long time and that maybe he would stay. But deep down I knew it would be hard, as Leo told me he thought the climate was too cold and that he would have a hard time learning this very difficult language. Leo had to do some work on his side of the family as well to accept our engagement. He had to ask his mother permission to get married because he was only 19, and under the law, he had to be 21. She also was not crazy about the idea of him marrying a German woman. But he told her that if she didn't agree, then he would enlist in the army for another 3 years and stay in Germany. She consented. On November 22nd, at around 7 p.m., we heard the news that President Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. Both Leo and I were devastated. Like most of the citizens of Berlin, we placed candles in the windows, mourning this great leader as if he were our own. Thousands of people gathered in the square where he had just spoken 5 months before. Once again, President Kennedy brought us together in a very profound way, but not in a way that we wished had ever happened. Leo and I were married in Germany in March 1964 and welcomed our first daughter, Michelle, later that year. Through many late nights of nursing and rocking our daughter, I thought about how someday I would tell her stories about how when I was a little girl, my girlfriend and I talked about America when we lived in a small town that was ruled by communism after the war. We had been evacuated from Berlin during the war and had to live in a town called Kolpin until we were allowed to return in the early 1950s. We thought everyone in America was happy all the time. They just listened to music all day and drove big cars. Throughout my young life, Americans were always the good guys, always thought of in positive light, and they saved our country after all. In May 1965, I held these positive thoughts tightly as I said a painful goodbye to my family and boarded a plane, hoping that they could visit in the near future. I held these positive thoughts even more tightly as I stepped off the plane in Little Rock, Arkansas, a small town with sweltering heat I had never known. The promise had been broken, but 49 years later, I am still here in Little Rock with three daughters, five grandchildren, and I just celebrated 50 years with that young American soldier. And while he never knew it, President Kennedy's visit to Berlin and his now famous speech brought together not only countries, but Menschen.
Thank you. Although she loves her adopted country, Helga Mullins proudly remains a German citizen. However, she would consider becoming a U.S. citizen in order to cast a vote for the first female president. In our final story of the night, let's go to the lake with Diana Hampo as a scheme results in an ending in Big Willie.
Liz, Mike, and I were not allowed to fish anywhere near Ms. Williams' end of the boardwalk. Then one day, she went on vacation. It was the late 1960s in my family's condo on Lake Hamilton in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Left to raise ourselves like coyote pups, my cousin Liz, Mike, and I ran wild. We spent our summer sunburned, half naked, and unfettered by stupid grown-up rules. At seven, Liz was our blonde but brutal dictator. I was the goofy-looking with stringy hair and big ears. And Mikey, he was scrawny, cheapskate, tough five-year-old who would bow up on a bus or throw down with a bear. He was either too stupid or too dumb to realize he only weighed 50 pounds. Mike thought he was Tarzan, Cold Stone Austin, rolled up in a taco with hot sauce. At the age of five, he was a bad A. We were young and skinny, but together we were formidable and frightening, full of really bad ideas and virtually unsupervised. At my house, the only adult who ever attempted to keep an eye on us was Lou Ella. She was our friend and our maid for 30 years. There was a lady who lived at the end of the boardwalk, Miss Williams. Every day at 4 o'clock, she lovingly fed all her pet fish in Lake Hamilton. She tossed out handfuls, boatloads of bread and corn, then watched as schools of fish appeared. We didn't really care about the brim or the sunfish, but good Lord, there was a monster of a catfish, Big Willie. He was nearly as long as a baseball bat or Mikey, and as fat as a football. This guy was beautiful, frightening, and Miss Williams loved him. But she went on vacation. The minute the car backed out, we started planning. Then, wearing nothing but our groovy swimsuits and our bad attitudes, we hauled our fishing gear down to the end of the boardwalk. Mikey bounced up and down on his linguine little legs as we watched the fish circling in the dark water. We threw out a handful of canned corn, and things got crazy. Lake Hamilton boiled with fishy action. Liz packed a bread ball and a hot dog onto the hook and dropped the line in. Mikey and I were lying on our bellies, staring at the fish. Then it happened. The line went taut. And Liz started yelling, "Holy crap, holy crap!" Reeling hard, she leaned back, and Mike and I jumped to our feet. Instantly, we realized on the first cast, she caught Big Willie. This was unbelievable. She cranked on the reel. We saw the massive submarine of a fish surface, then go down. We cranked on the line, but we were no match for Big Willie with our Kmart fishing rod. He pulled our line like a yo-yo. And Liz screamed, then cursed, then screamed, "Mike, get the dadgum net." The net was taller than Mikey by a foot. But he snatched it up, and he stood staring into the water, watching for his chance to scoop up Big Willie. Then Liz made an executive decision. She shoved 5-year-old Mikey into the lake with Big Willie. And started screaming, "Scoop him up, Mike. You catch him, or I'm leaving you in that lake. You hear me?" I helped her hold the rod as the fish tried to get away from Mike, his net, and kicking legs. There was a fishing line, splashing, screaming, then suddenly Mike yelled, "He's in! He's in!" Tiny Mike tried to hold the net up as he treaded water, but the fish weighed way too much, and he started going under. So Liz dropped the pole and stretched out on the boardwalk to grab it. She pulled the net and the gigantic fish onto the hot wooden planks. Mike desperately clung to his shorts as I hauled his rat body out of the lake. Liz had Big Willie flopping furiously in the net. His catfish mouth gaped open. He looked so angry and slimy. His whiskers that long. We had no idea what to do with this monster. The hook was poked through his cheek and the bread ball was still on it. And then his catfish eyes rolled in our direction and we stepped back. Liz pushed Mike, "Get the hook out." "Hell no, you get it." "You get the hook out," I said to Liz. She looked at me as if I was asphalt stupid. Then she picked up the net, waited for us to follow, holding the still-attached fishing pole, and we all walked toward the condo with Big Willie. When we got to the back door, Liz looked at me. "We can put him in the bathtub, right? He'll be okay." I nodded, proving I was asphalt stupid. We smuggled Big Willie into the living room. He dripped and flopped as we ran through the kitchen and upstairs to the bathroom. I filled the bathtub with cold water, and Mike leaned against the door so Luella and my mom couldn't push in. God save us if they got into the bathroom. Finally, Mike held the net as Liz and I raised the fishing pole with Big Willie still attached to the line. She let his massive gray body splash into the gleaming white tub. And for a little while, we held the pole and watched him swim slowly around the tub. Finally, Mike couldn't help himself, and he stepped into the bathtub and started laughing as the big fish swam past his leg. Liz and I got in, too, and we giggled like maniacs as Big Willie swam between our legs. His smooth skin felt magical. We laughed so hard, Mike started to pee in the tub. But we didn't care and laughed even harder watching the yellow cloud disappear until Luella walked in. It was terrible. Luella just stood in the bathroom staring at us in the pee water, and she started screaming. Then her screams turned to a breathless, "Miss Ann, get in here! Miss Ann, get in here right now!" When Mom arrived, we stopped laughing. Liz tried her fake cry, but nah, that didn't work. Mom told us to take Willie to the lake, cut the line, and let him go. I knew what was next. I made Luella watch while I got a spanking. I felt pretty certain she wouldn't let my mother beat me to death. Twice I looked up and realized Liz and Mike were laughing desperately, trying to swallow it, but they couldn't. And somehow that made the brutal spanking even worse. Yeah, it was like the best day ever.
Diana McDaniel Hampo has four ridiculously wonderful kids and a Hungarian husband who is the executive chef at Oaklawn Park in Hot Springs, Arkansas. She's a second-degree black belt in Taekwondo and has a blog at hampoland.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take take me back home.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.